And we were able to just be, again, it was, we were agile, we were creative. I was really proud that we were able to pull that off. Then the question is, well, can you raise the money?
All right, episode 23 of the Deal Ranch podcast. David Becker, head equity strategist here at Time Equities and senior managing director. You guys have, you know, an amazing company. Obviously, I found out about Time Equities through Francis's book, which is one of my favorite books, Risk Game. Really excited to meet you and kind of hear your story, but I'll let you give an intro on yourself to get rolling.
Yeah, so thanks for having me. This is great. I'm been looking forward to this. I sort of really enjoy these sort of in-person opportunities to chat, meet someone new, talk about experiences and what I see in the market and who I am and whatnot. So I went to Tulane Business, graduated, went to work for Arthur Anderson.
Yep.
Really, family's been in the real estate business going back to my grandfather, which we can get into. Came to work here at Time Equities in 1998. And other than a little period where I was focused on our family office with my brother, Becker Org, I basically have spent a majority of my real estate investment management career here at Time Equities and really seen the company really expand in a phenomenal way. And it's a great place to be associated with.
Absolutely. Can you give a high, before we kind of dive into your career, give a high level overview as your role and we can talk about how it progressed over time. And then also an overview and we can chat about Time Equities and then we'll get into kind of from Tulane to here.
Yeah. So Time Equities, so we're a diversified, privately held, but diversified real estate investment development firm. We're based here in Manhattan on Fifth Ave. We're really in a wide amount of markets, own a lot of different asset types. I think we're in 35 or 36 states, all over Canada, and six countries in Western Europe and the Caribbean. And we own everything from office to retail, to student housing, to residential. We build residential, we have land, we have industrial. I would say that we've primarily sort of focused on what I would call the major real estate food groups. Mm-hmm. We're not in the hotel business primarily because we see that more as an operating business than traditional real estate. But even more recently, we've even expanded well beyond real estate into alternatives and private equity and also involved in renewable energy now.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I want to talk about that. I know you guys did that bond issue too, but overview, I think close to $7 billion in assets, 340 properties, 36 states, I think, and six or seven countries. So as an overview, before we kind of trickle back into your career, so Francis is an amazing entrepreneur and historic. He kind of pioneered, in a way, the co-op and the condo conversion in New York City. So before we kind of go into your transition to Time Equities in the late 90s, can you give an overview, I think, of Francis and kind of the company and kind of how you guys, I mean, really pioneered New York City apartment living, really, co-op living?
Yeah, so Francis is Francis Greenberger is a true American success story. He is, I think one of the real estate legendary investors in the last couple of generations. Has the unbelievable ability to sort of see things before they're happening and has the wherewithal to sort of put it together and actually execute. But, you know, I mean, he found his first building at age 17 and found some investors, and his whole story is really an unbelievable one. So, he's built a phenomenal business here. You know, this company originally was New York City only. And we would buy rental buildings and convert them into co-ops at the time. And that was the major business in the 70s and really up until like mid 80s. During the SNL crisis, basically towards like the mid to late 80s, you know, he sort of needed to shift a bit. And he always tells this story, which I always find interesting, but he decided he needed to diversify outside New York. And so that led to a shopping center and an office building. And all of his friends at the time, the New York circle of developers, were basically saying, like, what do you know about a shopping center, you know, in Connecticut or an office building in Pittsburgh?
Right.
And he said, you know, I don't know that much, but I'm going to learn. Mm. And his ability to sort of just welcome that, learn, and, you know, that he knew he would make some mistakes, but he knew it was more important for him to be diversified. And when you fast forward to today, see the diversification of this company, it's really the strength of the company, because we're really not over-reliant on any one asset class, on any particular market region. And so, you know, that turned out to be actually one of the, you know, the real financial strengths of the company. And, you know, of course, when you look at it today and you see who we are. And the other thing is, you know, he remained private, and he, many people ask me, you know, how are you experts in so many different areas of the business? And it's how I grew up in the business, because I didn't know any thing else but to figure out what properties in different parts of the country look like. But it's turned out to be a phenomenal success story. He's an unbelievable person. He's got very, very high integrity. He's been a great mentor for me. And I've known him since I've been young, and learned from him. And, you know, obviously a benefactor of the arts and music and writing. And,
yep.
All of his other work, but he's built a great company.
To say the least.
Yeah, and he's created a quality of life environment here where, you know, you have a lot of stickiness with long-term employees.
Mm.
I mean, I'm approaching 20 years. You know, there's just
a lot of guys are 30 years.
It's very normal. And I think it's because he's created an environment where people like to come to work.
Yeah, I love it. So moving kind of to your earlier days at Time Equity. So 94, you finished school at Tulane, two majors. What was the initial thought after that? So you go to Arthur Anderson, like where were you right after college? Like what was the plan? Obviously moving back to the city here too, but like what was the thought process of what did you want to do, so to speak, after school?
You know, I was undergrad at business school at Tulane, and I was accounting and finance major.
Mm.
And what am I going to do from there?
Right.
You know, and my father, who I'll speak about, Robert Cantor, who we haven't spoken about yet, but we can, said, what should I do?
Yep.
And where am I going to position myself for business? And of course, his background is being a CPA and an attorney, and so he's very technical, and thought accounting would be a great way to just learn business and understand the numbers and financial statements and all of that. You know, it's not for everyone. It actually turned out it really wasn't for me, but where I went into Arthur Anderson thinking that I would learn accounting, you know, I came out having an unbelievable network of like-minded people that were ambitious, that were young, and there was an environment of how to work with other people and transitionally from work. So I actually had a great experience. I worked in their audit department for a year or two,
wow.
Transferred to their real estate consulting group, and learned a lot about underwriting and I think because I have that sort of base of understanding the underwriting, you know, it's enabled me to really sort of evolve as a businessman in the real estate business, because I actually understand. I don't spend too much time on it anymore, but I actually can walk through projections in a way that has been very useful. And I've got a great network of friends that all went on to various funds and REITs and whatnot that we stay in touch with. And so turned out to be, you know, a community that I value.
And then in 98, you transitioned to Time Equities. I read some article where it was like you had an offer maybe to go to Bear Stearns at the time and then wanted to go this route because it was more entrepreneurial, but also, and maybe a good segue for your family story here, but like, why did you want to go the Time Equities route as opposed to Bear Stearns? And then also, how, since you have this familial relationship with the business, how early were you involved with Time Equities? Like, were you when you were a kid or what?
Well, it's funny. The move from Arthur Anderson, you know, at the time, which, you know, CMBS was early CMBS years. And back then, all of the large investment houses were offering CMBS product. But they didn't have really the staff to actually evaluate the underlying assets and the deals and the underwriting. So they'd hire like an Arthur Andersen to essentially use the resources of, you know, intelligent, smart, educated people that could come in and do the analytical work. And so at that time, I was sort of on a team that was underwriting, providing valuation services and underwriting for a lot of the big banks. So that experience was very translatable.
I bet, yeah.
Because the banks really, it was easy to sort of go from an Arthur Andersen to, let's say, like a Bear or another one of the banks at that time, First Boston or whoever it might have been, because they knew you know how to underwrite and were
large deals,
sort of, yeah. You knew how to sort of look at it and price it and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So I came, but it was corporate, very corporate. Yeah. And I never really saw myself as a primarily corporate person and more of an entrepreneurial heart. So I came down, met with Francis, Bob Canner, Robert Canner, who's my father, stepfather, who married my mother back in 82. But I came down, met with Francis, and I got his advice.
So how old were you then? Like 22?
So no, I was 4 years out, so I was like 25, 24.
Okay, yeah.
25, 26. And I met with him. I said, well, what do you think? And he said, David, I just don't see you at an investment bank.
Right.
You have too big of a personality. You're more entrepreneurial. They're going to have you sort of working in one element of one transaction. And he said, why don't you come work here? And we had a great meeting. And I remember I went back and spoke to Bob about it. And it was really a natural fit. I mean, I came on here in 98. It's an acquisition and asset manager. And you know, the rest is history. I mean, other than a brief period where I was developing my family office with my brother, Beckerorg, I basically have spent my career here. And that was one of those decisions I'm really, really thankful for. I'm sure I would have done okay at Bear or another place.
Yeah.
But I was really able to foster my sort of natural, you know, entrepreneurial spirit.
What was a snapshot of the business as you recall it in 98 when you started? Like, do you know roughly like what markets are you guys in now that you weren't in? Then I know some of the global markets you certainly weren't, but like what was the AUM? Kind of what was the focus of the team?
I have to go back and look at AUM, but you know, probably certainly like, you know, I don't know, maybe $1 billion or something.
Dollars,
I mean,
yeah.
It's, you know, in that range, I have to think it's not more than that.
Right.
Now it was, and of course, a majority of the asset value was still centered around New York.
Yep.
So, but we owned a range of things. And at that time there was, we had been developing strategic partners. We had just moved into Canada a few years back.
Yep.
So we were, I would say more Eastern Seaboard mm-hmm. type stuff, regional, nothing like what the firm is today, where we're in so many different markets. But it was, you know, much more concentrated and the deals were smaller. Mm-hmm. You know, we relied heavily on our syndication business, and Francis's capital and banks really primarily for expansion. So of course, you know, we had limits.
Before we dive into your progression, I think one big thing or a couple things kind of to highlight. So at Time Equities, it seems like through reading Francis's book, which if anyone hasn't read it, certainly should. It's amazing. But there's one thing which to everyone should be the golden rule of real estate of always buying at the right price. And we were chatting a while before, but like
yeah.
he harps on that over and over and over again. Like if you buy at the right price, you might have a chance to succeed. If you buy it, you know, too high, you'll kind of never have a chance to succeed. But has that always driven every acquisition deal here, like that being one of the principles of the business?
So yeah, listen, this firm is really centered around being a contrarian investor. And part of being contrarian is typically buying cheap and working through problems.
Sure.
And we've always been more centered around the assets that maybe are the less glossier assets. And we've never really been able to compete. In more modern times, we're able to in some ways, but for the shinier assets that, you know, are priced at a higher level. So this firm really has been centered around, Francis wrote a speech a number of years ago that I draw from a lot, but it's buy it right, it's your only chance. And it's really centered around the price. And he speaks about it in his book too, The Risk Game, where, you know, risk is commensurate with reward, but he centered his philosophy around, if you buy something at the perfect price, you really have only one place to go, because nothing's ever perfect.
Perfect price being
meaning a higher price, less problems, full stabilization. But yeah, you know, but it centers the assumptions are centered around nothing going wrong. Like, it's perfect.
right.
And one thing we know for certain, nothing's ever perfect. Yeah. It never goes exactly as you expected. Right. That assumption is only, they're only as good as, you know, you can put on a piece of paper. And, that led to, well, let's buy things more distress pricing, more value oriented, buy things for a lower price, and then try and solve the problems and create the value. So this firm really has been centered around lower pricing, but value creation. And whether it's reposition, management, lease up, a range of different things, could be a forecast on a particular market. You know, if you look back at this company, you know, we went into Canada when it was contrarian. It was actually at a time when, like, there was essentially the discussion of the separatist movement back in the 90s, when they thought Quebec was going to basically separate out of the rest of Canada. So, of course, the markets went crazy. Banks didn't want to lend. And, you know, we had an interesting story about how, you know, we bought our first asset. And Bob tells a funny story about he got a call. We bought one of our first assets up there. I think it was 4200 St. Laurent, which is sort of like the Soho area.
Sure.
If you look at it now. Francis couldn't make the trip up to see the property. He was buying from the Proffman family. And Bob goes up and, you know, tells a story and, you know, about how he said he couldn't believe the guy, you know, basically one of the Proffmans called him into a side room and said, "You understand this deal, right?" Bob said, like, it was a huge 300,000 foot office building, like this building.
Wow.
That I think we paid, I think we were all in for like under $10 a square foot. So I don't want to, you know, exact numbers, but.
Sure.
And he calls Bob in and he says, "You know, Bob, you understand what's happening here?" Bob, like, didn't want to say the wrong thing. And I remember him saying, you know, "We're buying it really, really cheap." He says, "Yeah, I don't want to hear about it. There's a scratch on the elevator." And Bob left the meeting, called Francis, said, "Get out your checkbook." And, you know, it was a high quality building that turned out to be a phenomenal win. But for whatever reason, they didn't want to deal with it. And, you know, so when you buy things on a price per pound, really value oriented, you can make a lot of mistakes, but time typically is on your side. And there's a lot of ways to survive. And so that's really been a fundamental thesis of this company really since I have ever been here. And I think it was different than actually when the days of when Francis was doing the co-op conversion stuff back in the 70s and even the early 80s, because there he was competing with other New York developers who were looking to do the same thing, and they were bidding each other. And I think where he was different is he took the lesson of when it went wrong and applied it. And ever since, we've been value-oriented. And it's a combination of income, stabilization, buying, you know, something that you can be patient on, and that sort of leads to the buy and hold. But it's all centered around price.
This episode of The Deal Ranch is brought to you by Reed's Jewelers. If you're looking for a new watch, Reed's has it. They have a large selection of fine Swiss timepieces from Omega, IWC, Breitling, Grand Seiko, Tudor, and Tag Heuer. Since 1946, Reed's has been devoted to customer service and quality. Find a Reed's store near you or shop online at Reed's.com. That's R-E-E-D-S.com by clicking the link in the show notes. Moving back to like those early days, so you come in as in an acquisitions role, and then now you're senior managing director. You have a huge team, you have a huge equity division with funds. We have 1031 platform, and then now we have these bond issues for the renewable energy, which we can kind of talk about in a little bit. But when did you kind of see your role here changing over time or progressing? Because at least from what I've read, it didn't seem like that role existed as senior managing director. Like, how did your life evolve here over those like 10 years?
Well, it was interesting. I you know, when I came on here, I was an acquisition person, and I was looking for deals.
What size deals were they?
We were looking for, you know, different shopping centers. I remember, like, you know, just to show you the the spectrum of where you can work on things here at Time Magazine. I was managing a shopping center in Pleasant Valley, New York, upstate. Mm-hmm. And then in 1999, we bought 125 Maiden Lane. You know, so it was like I, you know, went from like a little shopping center to helping to work on Maiden Lane, which mm-hmm. was obviously something that Francis procured, but like, you know, through a relationship he had, but like just to be able to work on things that are entirely different, no correlation different. At all, yep. Or an office building in Ohio. You know, it was just very, but of course, when you can do that, you sort of learn how to evaluate a place, evaluate a deal, put the metrics up against what's happening in the market and sort of go from there. But when I had spent a few years in the sort of asset management looking for deals area, and the person and the person who was essentially running our investors at that time, we did like friends and family syndications investors, very small, a few million per deal. And the person who was running the investors accepted another opportunity somewhere else. And Francis came into my office and said, you know, what do you think about taking over the investors? And I had never really thought about capital raising. I mean, I was like, it's all about acquisitions. It's all about asset management acquisitions. Like, that's where the growth is.
So you were out looking for deals.
I was looking for deals. Yeah. Looking for deals. And then one thing we do very uniquely here is our acquisition people are also play dual roles, and they're also asset managers.
Well, it helps and them look at helps the deal responsibly.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, the idea is that you can't have a dream, but then you buy it, and then hand it off to someone else, and they have to execute your dream. You got to actually see your dream through, and you're responsible for the dream.
It's a good dream. Yeah.
So it puts a lot of quality control on the acquisition strategy because, you know, you can't run from it. Mm-hmm. So your assumptions better be good. And also, I just think the practicality of understanding how to actually operate buildings and what things really cost helps you actually formulate proper assumptions mm-hmm. into the underwriting. So it makes you a better acquisition person. So that's something that, you know, is somewhat unique here, which I think has been very useful for us. You know, I never really thought about the investor side of the business.
Yeah.
And it's funny, most people don't. Mm. And in fact, most acquisition people that I see across industries don't really, I mean, obviously the more advanced people, of course, but junior and mid-level people don't really understand really where the money comes from.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or the capital stack.
Right.
But I would argue that it's like the most important part of the game. And so I didn't really know what he was talking about.
Yeah.
And I said, like, I asked a couple of people's opinion. I said, Francis, why do you think this would be a good opportunity for me? Mm. And he says, I can't imagine someone who'd be better personality-wise to manage people's investment expectations. And so it was something that I'm grateful for because he saw it in me. I didn't really see that. And when I look back at that and what it's done for my career and who I am as a person and what I actually like am passionate about, and which is more people relationship oriented, less maybe about the particular deals of a given underwriting.
Right.
Although, you know, those are very important ideals. And like some people are better on that side, analytical people, but I'm not one of them. And so it's much more, for me, much more strategy, much more, that's really what sort of drives me, leadership, things like that.
Yep.
Having authentic relationships with people, and that's investors, partners, et cetera. And, I ended up moving into it, and I remember I went and asked Bob's advice, who's been another phenomenal mentor for me.
Of course.
And he said, I said, what do you think about this? He says, I think it would be very valuable if you could figure out how to like control a investor base and grow it. And I said, okay, I'm starting to think about it differently now. and of course, you know, that was sort of history, but we started building that business out. It became a natural fit for me.
And in a monster channel of your business or line of service at this point too.
Yeah.
What year was that when he came into your office? And
that was probably early 2000s. I there was a period where I sort of played a dual role where I was helping my brother build out our family office. There was actually also a 5-year gap where or set 5 or 7 year gap where I left Time Equities entirely and was building my our family the Becker business
organization.
And in 2008-09, I started having discussions when the market melted here. And of course, just based on my, you know, how I had, I've always been connected to Time Equities, even if I've like not actually been sitting in an office here. There was a period of time where we were, my brother and I had an office actually upstairs on the 18th floor.
Oh, wow.
So we would bounce down and,
that's awesome.
You know, it was very fluid.
Sure.
And by the way, you're getting real New York.
That's okay.
This is like,
it's not the first
time.
This is
good New York though. Yeah. But this is New York. So,
2008, you were with TBO, with Time. Okay.
Correct. And when the market melted, I started reflecting on sort of where would be the next great opportunity. Mm-hmm. And I came back to just meet with Francis and he said, you know, I think this is going to be an unbelievable opportunity to buy property. And, you know, why don't you come back and build our investment business so that we could really build our third party investment business out and really take advantage of some of these phenomenal generational buying opportunities. And when I did, I came back, it was 2010, and had always been sort of connected, but with the operation, of course, but we started then evaluating all the different ways that we could raise third-party capital. Mm-hmm. And that was an unbelievable learning experience for me to understand, you know, the capital market side of this business.
Good time to learn.
Because I understood where people really are going. And so they're very different channels. Mm. The first channel, you know, obviously is institutional.
Right.
But we went down a path and started speaking to institutional investors and placement agents, and we were talking about it. And this company had a good track record, so we were someone that were polished, and we could go to the institutions. But the problem with that for this company was, you know, that it didn't allow you to sort of move in different sectors, different locations. It wants focus.
Mm-hmm.
And economically, the deals that you're able to achieve from an institution are significantly less. They give you less freedom. They're not really buy and hold. So that model, for the most part, wasn't really consistent with the long-term strategy of this firm.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a number of reasons why we sort of moved off of that. Then you can sort of like, you know, go down like the, you know, the endowment strategy or the...
Right.
And we ultimately landed on the channel of like the independent broker-dealers, which was interesting because basically we raised the majority of our capital now through what I code as the independent broker-dealer channel,
right,
which is a series of investment firms that have wealth managers, RIAs, investment professionals that are essentially offering our real estate products to their client base.
Right.
So if you think about it, it's like real estate syndication, like family and friends, but on steroids. Because you're now, instead of having, you know, one investor dealing on a direct basis with one investor, you could be dealing with one client, a financial advisor, and he brings 20 investors. And so the multiplying effect of it,
it's a large channel.
Large channel. Yeah. It was interesting because in the year 2000, I was here to help like set up our broker dealer. But at the time, we were just doing friends and family syndication. So we became a broker dealer in 2000 because our advisors and legal people were telling us that it was the more conservative way to offer a product, even if it's on a friends and family basis, because you're doing it as part of a regular part of your business.
Sure.
But we never really offered it to the securities world.
Mm.
So we were sort of just, you know,
sitting on it.
Every now and then we'd put a syndication out, but it wasn't done in any way where we had a real expansion potential. In 2010 and 11, we started using the broker-dealer more strategically, and we started, and this is something that I'm really, really proud of because I built a team. We really went and hit the road, and we really figured out how to do it. A lot of it was trial and error, but we basically began to use the broker-dealer and started to, in a securities way, offer our product out to investment firms.
Mm.
And we would set up relationships with various investment houses throughout the U.S. And one by one, got to know them, started going to conferences. And it was a whole world that we entered.
Yeah.
That I've built some amazing friendships, relationships, We've raised a tremendous amount of capital, but most importantly, capital that's consistent with, you know, the long-term strategy of the firm.
Your principle, right.
So like it, you know, one of the reasons that we always liked the friends and family direct investor business was because typically investors, you know, we're an investor.
Yeah.
So it's aligned in the sense that most investors, when they're happy and in a nice cash flowing asset that's going up in value over time and getting tax benefits, et cetera, they're not looking to necessarily sell it.
Right.
That's very different than the institutional world that has exits and forced exits many times.
Yeah, they need to.
That are timing related that may not relate to the property.
Yeah.
It may relate to a cycle. It may relate to the other thing that I didn't mention was, you know, we'd also looked at going public. There's really three ways.
I didn't know that.
There's really a broker-dealer channel, which is what we do primarily. There's going public, and then there's the institutional private, but institutional strategy. Those are really the three primary ways in the real estate business to raise a substantial amount of capital. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's other offshoots, but that's primarily what it is. Yeah. And same sort of a dynamic with the going public, where Francis never really wanted to be beholden to a strategy that he didn't really think was in everyone's best interest. You know, he sort of made his success on being agile and being contrarian and being able to shift from one asset to another, one area to another. So by definition, that's not really a dedicated, focused approach. I have to buy office buildings, you know, in Pennsylvania. Those two models, the institutional and the going public strategy, never really fit the sort of the philosophy of the firm.
Right.
Whereas traditional investors, and using financial advisors, wealth managers, their investors are more income-oriented, they're more long-term focused. They don't really have, in large part, the need for the exit. And so it naturally fit for us. And we entered in an interesting way, but part of the first few years, and that was where we launched our first firm in the beginning of 2011, was us just introducing ourselves to people. So whereas you had this very well-regarded real estate investment company, in the financial world, no one knew who we were. I mean, the banks might have, because there were lenders to us. And we were, I think, regarded always very, very
highly.
And it was very, but, you know, financial firms were, they didn't know who we were.
Right.
So part of it, the first few years, was just telling the story.
That was, this is a perfect segue. So at the beginning of your career, I was reading, and I don't want to misquote, but it was something like Francis said in 2000 through 2007, they were doing 100 to 300 million in acquisitions a year. Then in 8 and 9, there was absolutely nothing. And then in 10, he started to see the opportunity. So that's kind of when you get re-brought in, right? So then 11, you launched the fund, and you already kind of hit on it there. But how hard was that, starting to build the brand? And like, what was the idea of raising that first fund? Was it, hey, we wanted to just kind of see where this goes and do one? Or was it a plan of rolling it out over time? Like,
well, I mean, let me give you a little context on that sort of build up. What happens in the real estate business that is very different than the stock market is there's a delay.
Yeah.
So, you know, we were buying actively in, you know, the 2000 genre. And again, I was here for majority of it, but there was a gap of time where I was still involved. You know, wasn't really, never really had any complete disconnection
separation
with the firm, just based on who I am and whatnot. But, so I would sit through acquisition meetings even on the years that I wasn't here. But, you know, when the market, went sour and really, so 08, there was a lag where you went from having deals to no deals. So the market freezes.
Yeah.
Whereas the stock market is very immediate.
Right.
You know, goes down really quickly. I mean, I remember being at dinners where you, like, people would be like, did you see what's happening on the market?
But a big drop.
In the real estate business, it's like, it's more economic. You're getting the delay of it. And the pricing isn't a lot of times reflected until it works its way through the system.
Right.
What was very different about what happened in, like, 08 versus, let's say, the SNL crisis, mm-hmm. like in the late 90s, was back then, you know, the FDIC came in and said to the real estate people and banks, mm-hmm. dump it. Right. You're not in the real estate business.
Yeah.
So if banks took over properties, you got to sell it, clear the market. So of course, what happened in a 2 or 3 year period, they would sell stuff for 10 and 15 and 20% of value.
Wow.
To get it off their books. Of course, 3 or 4 years later, it was back up.
Right.
And so what really happened in 08 was they didn't, I think, want to make the same mistake twice. Yeah. And so instead, the bank, if you remember with TARP and everything like that, mm-hmm. came in and backed the banks.
Yeah.
And so what that did was it was like slowing the process of the market clearing. So there was this period where there was no transactions because you know, the banks, sellers who had property had time.
Yep.
Buyers were trying to buy it at the new valuation, yeah. and you had a freeze.
Yeah.
And it's not too dissimilar for what's happening kind of now. Right now.
Yeah.
It was more exaggerated, I think, mm-hmm. then, but it's similar.
Still a big bid ask
big
gap, essentially.
Gap.
Yeah.
It had, the market is not cleared.
Yeah.
By any stretch.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you know, there are certain deals that you hear about where, you know, but it's usually when someone needs to refinance or, you know, the sponsor or the owner is maybe a weaker owner based on needing capital. Mm-hmm. Of course, the significant rise in interest rates happened so fast.
And insurance costs.
It caught off people off guard. Insurance costs. There's a number of reasons. But it's the forced one-off sale. And that's really like the real estate business that I know. It's the business of, it's not as if an office building in Texas is the same as an apartment complex in Michigan. I mean, they're entirely different. They operate in an entirely different subset. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, we've always wanted to sort of remain independent, both from the public markets and the institutions, because it's really not how this company has really been successful in buying property. It's being agile and shifting from asset class to asset class. You know, we were chatting just before we started about, you know, everyone was afraid of retail when it was, when, you know, Amazon, the online mm-hmm. effect. But now it's office.
Yeah.
And so because of remote work. So the markets change. And so being agile is huge. So, you know, in that period of like 09, it was a freeze. I remember sitting in an acquisition meeting in 09 here. And Francis saying, and the acquisition people tend to get frustrated because they're transactional by nature and they mm-hmm. want to buy deals. But the market hadn't reset yet properly for pricing, in our view, in a large way. So Francis said, look, let's spend time getting the house in order and button down the house.
Mm.
And, you know, there'll be a time where, you know, we'll be ready to start buying again. That's really what happened. And, you know, that fed into our fund because what we wanted, and one of the reasons why we designed that first fund, which we called like the TEI Diversified Income and Opportunity Fund, one, because it was exactly what that long
diversified income
the title is. Yeah. It's a diversified pool of income and opportunity mm-hmm. assets, but it was diversified and it allowed us to sort of go where the opportunity was. And so that was the beginning of us sort of telling the financial firms that, you know, we've been here a long time. I remember we developed a track record and this was 2012. And I said, you know, like, let's put a track record together mm-hmm. because, and publish like a track record because, you know, many firms don't have that. And we have the benefit of being a firm that was founded in the mid 60s and very successful. And
historic.
Yeah, I remember going back and saying, well, how long do we have to go back? And we picked 20 years because if you look at the date, It was basically 2012. I said, let's go back to 92 because I knew I couldn't actually track down the information in the 80s. Point. Like it would have been like not. And we said, you know what? 20 years is enough. But now people are like, well, why did it stop at 20? Why did you go back to 1992? I'm like, well, that was our first fund was moving in that.
Sure.
And I said, let's put a track record together. It was really that. It's been an interesting ride in that way.
So.
And now when I fast forward, we're on fund six. And there's been a lot of offshoot businesses. Mm-hmm. We accelerated, the fund business accelerated as people got to know us. And a lot of offshoot businesses came out of it. We have, I'd say, one of the major businesses that came out is 1031 Exchanges. in a customized way. And we knew that business very well because we do it for our own account.
Sure.
So we expanded that business. And now I would say today that business accounts for at least half, or I would say more than what our traditional fund business is.
Yeah, I want to break down that 1031 and then a couple cool things about the funds to highlight too that stand out after kind of picking through each of them. Was the first fund, did you raise $17 million in equity, or was that the total, because that's what the number says on life.
So,
or was that the asset purchase?
Yeah, so no, it was all of our funds really just raise, we offer, when we buy a $25 million office building, just throwing a number out.
Sure.
$5 million might come from our funds. Mm-hmm. $5 million or $10 million might come from exchanges.
Yeah.
$5 or $10 million might come from the principals of the firm. We might be doing our own exchange, but internal capital.
Got it.
It's a series of different, could be some of our direct investors. And everyone's sort of taking a piece of the pie.
Mm-hmm.
So when we raised like our first fund, no one knew us. So it took us 6 months, 9 months, 12 months to even get on everyone's platform.
I bet.
That you could even allow, where they could allow their brokers or advisors to actually sell our product. So that was a process.
Mm-hmm.
Once you sort of were able to do that, you would then get referred to another broker dealer and another broker dealer. It was all about awareness.
Yeah.
So what we were offering was, you know, we raised like $17 million in that first fund, which I know sounds small in context to this size of this firm, but that $17 million had the ability to invest $1 million in one deal, $1 million in another deal, $2 million here. So it's got 20 or 30 assets in a diversified way. So it's almost like a little mini real estate investment mutual fund in some ways.
Yeah, 100%.
And that was sort of like, you know, and again, that was represented just a segment of a business that we were really fostering to build up a distribution channel so that we weren't over-reliant on principal capital of the firm or one major partner that would dominate the capital structure. So that's been a very important feature that we've been able to maintain that ability. And we had less pressure because, you know, it was very, for me, someone who was heading up capital, it was nice to be able to go in and sell strength because I wasn't really focused on the amounts. I was focused on awareness and getting the right people and knowing that we could do it in an authentic, sort of honest, transparent,
to represent time equity
integrity way. And that, you know, I always tell people, still to this day, we want the money, but we don't need the money. And so when you're raising money and you mean that and it's real, it's a huge advantage because you're basically not making decisions based on the capital.
Mm-hmm.
Which a lot of people, experienced real estate investors, will tell you that's where you make mistakes.
Yeah.
And that you have to stay true to your investment principles and your philosophy for buying and owning and managing and being upstanding citizens and following the code of law. So those are things that I was able to do. And it slowly, just one by one, got traction. And I started building a team. And
it's worked out pretty well.
Yeah, it's been great. It's been great. And now, when you fast forward, $1 billion later,
I would say,
of capital.
So as the funds kind of evolved, so $17 million was the one raised. I think fund three was like $67 million, and then fund four was $127 million. So like you guys started to really pick up speed quickly, which I found unique. But then also the percentage that you guys co-invest is like between 30 and 40%, which seems staggeringly high for a sponsor or someone putting together the fund to do. So like, I wanted to ask you that when I was prepping. What's the importance of that? Do you think it speaks so highly of the fund? Also, you guys are generating a good return from that. But like, what's the importance of you guys seeding the deals with 30, you know, a third of the capital on your own?
You know, primarily what it really is that we're investors looking to make good deals.
Right.
And that we really want, and our objective is to attract investors that can be aligned with us and to treat their capital the way we're treating our own. And I would even make the argument that we're more conservative with investor capital than our own capital in the sense that we'll take risk, but not necessarily offer to our investor base until we feel like we understand the risk in a way that's manageable.
Sure.
Meaning going into a new place or a new country or of some kind. Yeah. And I can give you a couple of examples of where that happened. But the co-invest is meaningful, but primarily it relates to the simple answer is that we're investors and we are looking for good deals. And if it's a good deal, we want to invest in it.
Sure.
And we're investing, we're really inviting investors to join us as opposed to find a grouping of investors and then go out and find the deal. So we're finding the deal and buying the deal either way.
Mm.
And I think that became a very attractive feature for people because people could identify with us as co-investors and we're in an alignment.
Right.
And that we weren't just trying to sell them something. I mean, we're, you know, we go in a contract to deal, we do due diligence. We're doing it anyway, if it meets our tests. And if it's not, we're not buying it. So, and I think, you know, that today, it's been a very, very important component of this firm's success. But, you know, knowing that you're managing it and that, you know, we're aligned on our structure and how we participate, it's all predicated over preferred returns that we're really in the profit business. We're in the business of properties going up in value and building cash flow. People ask me, like, how would you describe, like, what Time Equities does? I'm like, we're in the real estate accumulation business.
To go
we're just accumulating. And it's that really what we're trying to do is build up cash flow in a series of properties that are not connected to each other. And one of the advantages with the way our system is built is that, you know, every single property is owned in a single purpose LLC, every single one.
Wow.
So nothing is connected to each other other than common form of ownership, meaning the fund at the parent level is consolidating and has ownership interest in various deals. But it's not as if one bad apple can spoil the bunch. And that is different than the public markets or even some of the institutional funds. Because you can isolate a problem, and it doesn't impact necessarily the. It might impact the overall strategy of how a fund might perform, because
but it's not spoiling
together.
The funds.
It's not spoiling.
Right. Yeah. So as far as grouping of the funds, as you kind of pick through one through five, right? Funds one through five, and you see it almost like there seems like different strategic concentrations, right, that each fund may have. Like one fund seemed very central east, and then some maybe northeast, and then west based, and then you start to add international as well. But so the properties, but the products changed over time too. I think in fund five, you started buying distressed debt, which seemed different for you guys. So I was curious, do you see an opportunity in this market with a lot of these loans coming to maturity? Like how do you decide kind of what goes into your mutual fund or this like collection, you know, deal by deal?
You know, because we're out there just looking at opportunities and we're offering our investors what we think is interesting at that time. And because these funds, what we typically do is we have a 2-year fund.
For the raise?
For the raise, but we're buying along the way. And then once we're done, meaning like fund one ended at December of 13 and it has X capital. But it doesn't mean that it won't continue to buy, because some of the properties we would buy all cash, and then we would put financing on, and then that would be fund one's money, and we'd go and buy another property.
Huh.
But primarily, the strategy only changes per each fund based on what we're focused on during that buying window and where the fund has cash.
Right.
When the funds got bigger, obviously the diversification became more... we became wider spread.
Yeah.
But, as an example, you know, when we were buying internationally, we started buying more actively internationally in the last 10 years. But in the beginning, we weren't sure how investors would feel about that. But then we sort of said, what if we just capped it as a certain percentage of what the fund could invest?
Oh, interesting.
Meaning, if we think it's a good deal to buy, we want to be able to offer them everything that we think is
a good deal
worth buying,
yeah,
because we don't want to cherry pick it. It's actually the opposite. We want to be able to offer them wherever our strategy is at the time. And because our strategy is agile and moves and is opportunistic, it changes, meaning based on what is available at the time, how the market's pricing it, where relationships come from. You know, we have a lot of strategic partners
I would say
throughout the US and Europe and Canada. And so it changed only based on, well, what capital was available at that time and where we were capital-wise and whatnot. So it's actually very consistent with us just continuing to expand into new asset types.
Yeah.
So international became something that is now integrated into all of our funds. It's just in the early funds, we weren't actively buying as much, and we weren't sure. We were new to the broker-dealer channel. We didn't really know regulatory-wise how people would feel about it. But in the end, they actually were buying into us as investment managers.
Wow.
You know, I always say what I would see a lot when I would go out and speak on panels and go to conferences and talk to people, I would see a lot of times that the mistake the investors would make is they'd pick the wrong jockey. And that, you know, they would focus on sometimes
the horse too
the
much.
Deal
yeah.
more than the manager. And, you know, our strength is the infrastructure, the strength of the company, our network, our financial capabilities, our experience, our people, you know, our reach capability, the fact that we're in all these markets. So that's where I think people started catching on that, you know, you're actually with us investing more in our funds, the broader context of it. And, you know, as opposed to a given deal. Now, when you get to like a 1031 exchange that has to go into a specific transaction, that's a little bit different. But our funds are primarily guided towards growth, tax benefits, appreciation over the long term.
And so buying them at all good prices.
And so we would add international. We started adding debt. It wasn't only buying some distressed debt. It was really going into B note positions where we would lend in a B note and we would get comfortable with the asset value. And it was something that I had been trying to get Francis to think about for a number of years previously. He never really has that mentality to be a lender. He thinks equity, the core of this company is to own and operate and be in control of your destiny. And lending is very different in that way, but there's good yield. So when we had more capital, the other thing that became clear is that we weren't going to force deals because we had capital.
Right.
So how do you get the capital out?
Yeah.
And in the funds, you're paying a preferred return on it on an annual basis. You're sending out quarterly distributions. Yeah. It's not good with the money sitting at the checking banks and sitting there earning nothing. So you have to sort of move with the markets. And I can tell you how that correlates to today, which is the reverse of that.
Yeah.
That the equity, in my view, is out of favor relative to what you can get from the banks because the market hasn't fully repriced yet. And you can get debt instruments in some ways are more attractive unless you're talking about buying opportunistic pricing. So when we started doing the debt arrangements, it was just a way for us to organize capital, get low teens returns, and keep the money working. And if we got paid off, we got paid off and it was a good transaction. And but we always got comfortable, and this is a scenario that just recently happened, where we foreclosed on the developer because they, you know, so we got comfortable with the basis that we were lending at.
So you're lending as if like you feel comfortable owning the asset at that basis.
Yeah, we won't
so
lend on something that
that's
we
right.
that okay. at our basis, if we had to own it, we're not comfortable owning.
That makes sense.
And so that was our risk protection quality control.
Wow.
And so it actually, on a large property we have on the West Coast, we actually never really envisioned
kind of
actually,
worked out.
You know, like a Class A multifamily.
Wow.
On the West Coast. And we didn't plan on owning it. We planned on getting paid off.
Yeah.
Now we own it.
So, that's cool.
Yeah.
So we spent a good bit of time on the fund business, but another thing as far as your services that stands out and fits well in with the fund business, but I'm curious kind of how it came to be, and you already mentioned it, but this 1031 exchange platform. So it seems very easy to use. It's marketed very well on the website as well. But can you kind of give an overview of, like, I guess, why do you guys rolled it out? Does it also feed into the fund business for you as well? But I think
it's my favorite.
It's a really neat
capital.
Product.
It's my favorite capital at the moment because, and I say that intentionally, because you're really dealing with families and you are really helping them reorganize based on where they are. So I saw We had always been doing our own 1031 exchange, so we were very familiar with it. What's offered in the marketplace, in the securitized marketplace, is a product called the DST, the Delaware Statutory Trust. Mm. But it's not really in alignment, in our view, with long-term ownership. There's restrictions on it. Can't really buy value add because it doesn't. The structure itself doesn't really enable you to reposition assets, spend money, lease things up, add financing, do all the things that are traditional real estate ownership things for like a buy and hold player. So it's more transactional, it's more Wall Street oriented. I saw an opportunity to customize these larger exchanges. So we have essentially like $1 million minimum policy, but we're dealing with people like literally from $1 million to $50 million in one transactional amount, meaning they're selling a building, selling a collection of assets. And what we offer is essentially a replicate of what we did with our own internal capital, primarily Francis, Bob, others, partners, et cetera, where we would sell something and reposition it. So we would go into a deal all cash that had no debt on it. We'd then do an exchange. We'd then put financing on it, turn the capital back on a tax-free basis, reposition it, diversify it. Wow. And so it was a very successful mechanism of how this company became
for these guys
so substantial. Yep. This firm really, Francis would always admit he's never a good seller. Meaning, you know, one of the, you know,
it's like, he doesn't like to sell. It doesn't seem
it's
either.
Just not his. I think partly he would always say he just would want to see things to the end, and he felt there was more value at the end of the line. And if he didn't need to sell something, he didn't really understand why we should be selling it. It wasn't really in the benefit of time. You know, it wasn't really in the best interest of like long-term value. You know, he's an owner. He's like a equity owner. And so what I saw in the channel that we were operating with after we put a couple of funds together was all these financial advisors that have clients that didn't really have an answer for a lot of these larger families, didn't really want a Wall Street product. They needed someone to reorganize them, to diversify them. And so we came up with a customized strategy for 1031. And what I love about it is you can deal with a family or a patriarch that wants to step out, that wants his children to take, you know, to have the benefits of his real estate success or otherwise, but maybe they're not in the business or they have no expertise in that way because they're doing other things in their life. So there's a whole range of reasons that occur where, you know, someone in the family was real estate. It could have just been that it was owned for a long period of time. And then someone, they need to sell it. And you have a whole bunch of family members that are relying on it, or partners are splitting. There's a whole reason. And so I saw a great opportunity for us to position ourselves as like a custom player. And so far it's been great. We got a unique structure. We're very creative. People see us as creative. I think when people talk to me, I like to think that they know I'm really thinking about how to give them a series of different flexible options. And if you think about it, all I was doing is really applying who we are as a company and being agile to a marketplace. Mm-hmm. And like, that was my takeaway. I mean, the number one thing I think about that I really am really, I should say, grateful that I'm here in this environment is that I'm an independent thinker and I'm able to have the freedom to think independently. And so this was just a product dynamic where I saw something I thought we could provide value to people. And little by little, we get out there and, people start hearing, well, wait a second, Time Equity is offering 1031 exchanges? Yeah. And of course, there's an unbelievable demand for that from the advisor point of view, particularly as things ran up on pricing because people were trying to take advantage of
getting out. To put their money somewhere.
The market slowed down a little bit, but now it's actually picking up back again, because people are getting a little bit more comfortable and maybe their sale was already in motion. So there's a series of things going on.
Fascinating. So without going wildly too in-depth here, so there's a pref. They're getting a preferred return, 5-7, I think, somewhere the website says. But are they picking from a series of assets that you guys already own that you said you're in cash on? Like,
Yeah. So a lot of it's timing. There's a lot of rules centered around the 1031 exchange timing. If someone's they sell a property from the day they sell, it goes into escrow, and then they can't touch it. Has to stay in the escrow, and then they have 45 days from the date they sold to actually designate where they're going to go. And then within 180 days from when they sold, they have to actually close on that property. Mm-hmm. So timing becomes a large feature of the importance of what happens here. Typically what happens with us is we keep a very organized chart of who's where and where they are in their process. And it's not changing what we're looking at. It's just trying to, I'm like a matchmaker.
Yeah.
I'm literally looking at the deal sheets of what we might have and seeing what
the investors'
the timing demand is. And of late, and I think this just speaks to sort of the importance of sort of this department, my team, and frankly, the future of this company. If you think about capital, it's fuel.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good segue. You know, because we wanted to be able to have a channel to distribute so that people could live well beyond, you know, this, we're at the 50 plus year mark for this company. When you get to 50 years, you know, JP Morgan was a 50 year company at one point, point in history.
Yeah.
So you start looking at 100, meaning, and I think, you know, the hope is that, and I think we'll realize it, that this firm will live well beyond its founder years, and that it'll provide a place for people to continue their careers, build their network, expand, but also where the acquisition folks have adequate third-party capital at the right time. So it's a tremendously important feature for this firm going forward. And so there's a lot of collaboration now between the acquisition teams and my team, and it's, you know, one of the reasons why I sit on the executive committee, obviously, and try and lead people, because now it's become a lot more, well, strategy. Like, it's knowing the pulse of where the investors are, what their timing is on the exchanges, et cetera. So it could just be that we're offering them something that we're working on, and it works within their timing.
Fascinating.
But we bring a creative element to it, and because we have strength and capacity as a financial player, we can take some of the timing out of it. I mean, we can hold a reservation, close with our own capital or capital that we arrange for, and then offer it to an investor post-closing. Oh, wow. So we're not necessarily reliant on investors to close transactions.
Because you guys can do
that. That creates a whole nother advantage for us to be able to offer product to people.
Fascinating. As far as bringing it all the way to modern date, I don't know, like, I want to talk about one deal story. I know we were talking about it earlier a little bit. Want to hear that, but one of the biggest things that stand out as far as time equities, whether you read it in the book or you just are aware of Francis or you just know the properties, but 50 West and 1000 M in Chicago, like, there are these, I don't even know how you would best describe them, short of, you know, incredible,
staying power.
They're unbelievable properties. 50 West, if you haven't looked it up, obviously look it up, near Wall Street, and then 1000 M south side of Chicago.
Like 1000 South Michigan Avenue. Yeah. South Loop, Chicago, Michigan Avenue.
Unbelievable architectural designs, these powerhouse. So 50 West, 64.
The famous architect. German architect that passed away in the last few years in a terrible accident, but was friendly with our chairman. But
he designed both, right?
Yeah. And their signature designs. Yeah. I think actually 1000 M was his last actual design, I think.
Project,
not corrected. But listen, going back to 50 West, I'll tell you.
So 64 stories, 191. 64
story, luxury high rise, residential, a couple blocks south of the World Trade Center on West Street.
Yep.
Beautiful building. Luxury, you wouldn't believe some of the pricing in there. I've seen it. There's one left for sale for
$37 million or something.
To this day, as a real estate person, I will never understand New York City, the pricing. And that's someone who, like, has lived here my whole life.
Bought and sold it, too.
I just don't, you know, it's the pricing. It's almost amazing at times
what
the pricing is. But that project actually, I mean, going back to the sort of the essence of it, it was a live-work building at the time. Before, it was a live-work property that was damaged significantly in the 9/11 fires.
Yeah.
So, you know, 9/11, obviously a terrible incident for the country and lower Manhattan, you know, the depth of that. But physical building damage was widespread.
Yeah.
So that property really became a question mark in terms of how you could resurrect it as a live work, because the work you would have had to spend to get it where it needed to go. And so there was a series of things that happened that caused us to sort of like, what is the highest and best use for that property? Turns out it was a high rise residential development. you know, that's, that deal lived 100 lives. Our director of development, Rob Singer, did an unbelievable job. I remember we were originally out looking for financing for to build the tower, but it was condominium financing. That was at a time when the market was not really favoring condominium, residential condominium. Right. And we were not someone known as someone that would build 64-story high-rise towers. We were known as a very capable investment company developer, but not someone that's in the high-rise space. Mm-hmm. So that property lived its own life, but we ended up getting two major institutions to back us, one that Rob came up with, one that I came up with, and we were able to build that building, and it turned out to be a phenomenal success story. That sort of led to, well, like the same way we might go into a new market, well, like we should have a development business, and maybe not a development business that's pumping out a project every 6 months, but
strategic development.
I don't think like we'll ever be like related. I think it's strategic sites, strategic things. And so that sort of was the beginning of just the same way we would go into Germany or the Netherlands or Canada or wherever we might be going, more recently Portugal. You know, that led to, well, we can be looking at development sites. The one in Chicago actually started through one of my relationships originally. Someone that I knew, I became friendly with, was doing a lot of business in Chicago, the Carlicks, and had a nice rapport with a father-son team. And they brought us a deal that actually was, we were buying something on a foreclosure. And it was, it was relatively small, but we had a high coupon on it. And fast forward, it was essentially a large land assemblage site, and we assembled a property and created a what is now a 74-story high-rise residential rental property. And that led to, that, by the way, lived its own life because, you know.
It was condos first.
It's condos first. We couldn't find the financing.
And now
730 apartments. Couldn't find the debt financing because lenders at that time did not want to.
So this was 19 that it, the buildings?
Yeah, about that. Okay. Sounds about right.
So then through COVID.
I mean, we're about to, we just recently topped off the building and we're about to complete the building in at the end of this year. So it was probably, I would say, 1920, of course.
So it lived its own
life.
You drop
a little
thing
called pandemic COVID.
Right.
Not the easiest thing to finance.
Sure.
But, and so it turned out that it was easier to get debt financing on a large rental tower.
Because it's income producing.
Income producing, yeah. And institutions are more familiar with it. You know, mm-hmm. if you think about condo financing, you know, the worry is that you sell half the building, the other half is sitting there fighting for it. And, you know, what do you really own at mm-hmm. the end? And so that's not really something that banks and primarily institutional investors can really get their heads around. Of course, there's more premium mm-hmm. on an exit through a condominium pricing than typically what would be a residential mm-hmm. rental build. But because cap rates had compressed so much on rental properties, we were able to sort of back into this being actually a very interesting residential rental high rise, luxury high rise. And we were able to get Goldman Sachs primarily to lead the way on the construction financing. And then we're left with, well, how do you go finance $150 million of equity?
Right.
So as part of the explosion of the 1031 space,
oh, neat.
We started sort of like back and forth. There's all these discussions about, well, how could we sort of bring that product, de-risk it for them? Mm. And we ended up coming up with a ground lease structure that I don't want to give too much secret sauce
away. It's okay. You don't have to.
But that turned out that we essentially structured more or less, you know, a lot of the investors in a ground lease position that insulated them from risk because we had all of our equity subordinate to, you know, call it A, B, and C tranche. A was the lender. B was the sort of grouping of 1031 exchange investors that qualified for 1031. And then, you know, C tranche was us. And so we had a substantial amount of equity. We had guaranteed the loan. But it was also a way for us to, so we de-risked the money so that they had lower risk. But it also made the project feasible because the cost of the funds was substantially less than what some of the sort of vulturist opportunity funds might want out of a mezz position. And so it really was a true win-win, I think, for everyone. And we were able to just be, again, it was we were agile, we were creative. I was really proud that we were able to pull that off. Then the question is, well, can you raise the money? And it turned out that, we went out to people, we were creative on the offerings. And so now you have these two phenomenal buildings that were built in very different styles. The deal that I was going to mention is the deal down in Florida, which similar story. But the 1000M story I'm really proud of is one of the deals. Not only did the company have the staying power and the wherewithal and the creativity to actually design and develop one of the, I think will be the phenomenal skyline properties of a major U.S. city in recent time, but the creativity behind the capital structure was phenomenal. And it was something that I think, you know, it's always nice when everyone can have a win, and I'm hopeful that we'll see that through and it'll be great. But we were able to raise it through essentially our 1031 exchange business. And who knew?
Yeah, it's a beautiful deal end to end from the capital stack and the development. But when does that start leasing? You're saying end of this year will be complete, so like a spring 25?
Yeah, we're actually just started our pre-leasing. We're actually like probably by the time this
so the marketing goes live.
Yeah, yeah, so the marketing has started. You know, we have waiting lists and demand potential buildup, but obviously we're finishing the but we're, I think, by May, middle of May, we're going to deliver the first 20 floors for occupancy. So we're in pre-leasing mode now, and I think we're coming out publicly in the next, you know, couple of weeks. That's going to sort of introduce, you know, the ability to lease. And so, you know, I think we're all excited to see it leased up. It's a lot of apartments. It'll take time. Yeah. But, you know, we built in absorption. And, of course, you know, then the important component there will be an interest rate environment when we look to refinance at some point.
Yeah. And kind of wrapping up a little bit here, is there any other property that you wanted to highlight? I didn't want to cut you short. You guys own no shortage of amazing real estate. You own Beaver, which is where Delmonico's is. Yeah, I mean, you guys own pretty much everything that's cool here in some respect. But you had a lot of activity last year, too. And then I saw a closing article a couple of days ago about a retail shopping center maybe in Kansas City that you guys
bought. We bought recently, which was Overland Park, which is, I think, a nice deal. I mean, we have a very, very strong retail team. I mean, one of the advantages of this company is we have the way we're set up is we have deal teams. You know, senior deal person. We have a
more junior Ami.
Well, we have like Ami Ziff, who heads up our national retail team, and phenomenally successful, talented professional that has built a great team. And so we own 100+ shopping centers and or malls, strip centers, et cetera. So we've become a force in the retail space, and we've really been able to sort of start getting some efficiencies on tenants. And he's done a phenomenal job buying properties well and being able to finance them. But we have other teams here that Aaron Medeiros, who has really headed up our a lot of our European investment strategy, along with one of our partners, John Schleppens, out in the Netherlands. But, just to name a few, we have people that focus. He's primarily an office player for the most part, but he, you know, obviously could do anything. He's a very experienced, you know, deal manager. But we're set up where we have seasoned deal people that have people under them that are focused on certain areas. Max Pastor, who's one of our senior deal leaders, also, you know, the new sort of like vice president of the firm, leads a great deal team on industrial and some housing and things like that. So usually we have a team, Brad Gordon, Bobby Cohan, that are focused on student housing as of late. So we have like almost specialty teams that operate sort of in a silo in a way that they're focused on a particular niche that they've seen some expertise in that they're, and you know, of course they can expand beyond that and cross over and we all collaborate together, of course, but it's led to some specialty expertise that we've, you know, I think that's benefited us. So that's led to all these different deal strategies.
Yeah, that's awesome. Last couple of questions to wrap up. So anything that you guys are focused on, and good segue here, anything you're focused on now that like we didn't get a chance to talk about today, like what is the focus of the Time Equities team? We've got a unique market structure right now, obviously interest rates, and some people may think they're going to drop next year. Some people may not, but regardless, we have a big, big bid-ask spread on properties, kind of like what you're alluding to earlier. Insurance is interesting, depending on the markets. Vacancy is kind of higher, even for multifamily a little bit, in some where there's a lot of newly developed supply, and then obviously office. But any big focal point for you guys kind of this year and next year?
Well, one of the things that I think is a big advantage for this firm is that we're pretty agnostic. Yeah. And, you know, we're looking at things sort of eyes wide open, and we're letting relationships and opportunities come our way in different segments of the country, different property types. Obviously, right now, the buzzword that people are afraid of, office. Mm. You know, remote work. I remember Bob, we were in a meeting during in March of 20, and we were discussing, like, whether we should shut the office down. And it was before the state said, shut it down.
Yeah.
And I remember Bob said, which always, I think we all sort of like agreed with, but if you you send people home, it'd be really hard to get them back.
Mm.
And, you know, fast forward, it's really hard to get them back now on a full-time basis in a way that's keeps the demand for office space where it should be in theory, or maybe, you know. So the market is continually trying to re-understand that where it sits now. You know, so you add that to interest rates, insurance issues, political issues, you know, climate issues. There's just a series of problems that are surfacing at once. And then you have a market that is a little bit frozen in the sense of not repricing itself. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. But I would say that we're just really looking to be opportunistic. I mean, we're really trying to buy better than the market and have it be sustainable. I mean, one of the things that we always say is, you know, when you're evaluating a property, tell me where the NOI is today. Tell me where you think it could be a couple of years from now and beyond. Because we think in that sort of sustainability concept. So, you know, personally, I feel most comfortable with industrial. I think the demand is industrial is not going away. I think that a lot of industrial development didn't happen because of the cost of the interest that certain industrial developers are facing. So I think that there's a little bit of a hangover for demand. That's sort of, you know, depends on who you ask,
sure.
But from what I see, so to me, below market leased industrial, downside protection, sort of a lazy man value add in terms of waiting for the rent to surface, and maybe a lease up opportunity. I think multifamily, obviously, the problem with multifamily is everyone thinks multifamily has the lowest risk profile of a asset class. It's not that it doesn't have the demand. It's not that we don't have the housing demand. It's what did you pay? And gets back to the first thing we started talking about, price. Always. And what did you pay? So it's not as if it's not a great asset, just like the one that we took ownership of on the West Coast. It's the developer got caught. And so it's, you know, in a pricing dynamic. So it's not that the asset, it's not,
a good
it's
point.
Never really about.
What are you in it for? Kind of what your cost of capital that seems
to be. And where the, like, where you are and do you have to contribute more money and what, you know, a lot of times you want to buy, it sounds more of a distressed selling position than you do a stressed asset. Meaning that, you know, if the asset is distressed for particular reasons that relate to challenges, whether it's the market or whatever it might be with the building, that's different than timing of when
getting a distressed seller, you're saying.
Yeah, I mean that, if you're just sort of being honest about it. So I think that, you know, we're continuing to sort of look at a range of things. You know, we, because we have businesses that range in all different asset classes, we're just really sort of looking at them one by one. And, you know, I think there's probably some decent retail opportunities out there. But, you know, if you asked me, it'd be industrial below market leased with some lease up opportunity. And, you know, office, suburban office, I think in the city, suburban office, well, I think in the major cities, I think is different than the suburban office market. And I think in suburban office areas that you have older inventory with obsolete buildings that are not. Today, if you want to have if you think about a building today because of the remote dynamic, you have to sort of find a way to amenitize and draw people in. And, you know, that is as important as anything, I think. So some of these buildings, I think, are converting. I mean, we're converting a property that we bought very opportunistically, but in Virginia, that as an office lease-up deal, but our basis is very low, but we're looking at a residential scenario.
Wow.
And so, you know, but you have to be at the right basis. Yeah. So I think that's an opportunity. But, you know, it's really case by case and deal by deal.
Last two questions. So is there anything you
guys... That's it?
Maybe more.
I can go... I'm like...
We've kind of spoken about like the whole shebang of what you guys do, right? All of these different lines of service, all these different platforms, all these different assets, all these different global markets. Is there any asset class, market, asset size that you haven't done that you're like, oh man, we want to do this? Or is there anything that like Francis is itching to, like he wants to do this that he's never done before? Is there anything that stands out that would be a first for you guys that's still...
You know,
of interest.
Because I guess we're just in a lot of them so far, you know, I see it more being maybe, you know, people typically will bring us deals based on relationships we have. Right. I don't think even Francis, who acts as our sort of our chairman. And head, and, you know, the deal people have a lot of, you know, fluid in that, you know, they're very, they search stuff out. I mean, mm-hmm. Francis is more reacting and not out there saying, well, I want to buy an office building or apartment complex in Texas or Oklahoma or Arizona. So it's really the deal people that become and it's our contacts and our relationships that they're really bringing. And then what we're doing really when we sit around the table is we're sort of punching holes in it. And we punch as many holes as we can. And if it doesn't die, it advances. And so... I'm personally, I'm a little bit negative right now on where I see real estate pricing. So, cause I think a lot of this stuff that is out there has not really been priced in fully. Mm-hmm. So, I think like for us, I'd like to see us very cautious. The number one asset I'm thinking about is our investor class asset. Cause that's the most important asset in a lot of ways, because, which is why, like, we have to do what we say. We have to obviously remain transparent. We have to have high moral fiber. We have to do our best. You can't, no one's expecting you to be a magician. If you were a magician, it'd be a lot easier, meaning, like, it wouldn't be, you're making a set of assumptions based on your experience and your, and in the end, like, people are relying on you. And, so we take that fiduciary responsibility. I mean, I take it personally. My team takes it personally. I know that all the other principals here take it personally. So that's a huge, to me, it's figuring out, if anything, how to continue our process of customizing and figuring out what it is investors need and potentially starting to adjust certain features that make our product more favorable to them, not to raise more money, but to actually provide them with like a better experience.
In actually one thing we did forget, the renewable space you guys got into the last couple of years, Carly Quinn pointed this out to me, and I think it incredible thing that you guys are doing. But did you want to mention the Oleo X?
I don't need to really issue the. I mean, basically, we've in the last six or seven or
at least given over.
This just speaks to the opportunistic nature of this company. Yeah. based on our contact base and, frankly, you know, the fact that we have so much, you know, entrepreneurialism here. People are always looking to bring ideas to the table. And, you know, I would say majority of my day getting pitched.
Internally and externally. Yeah.
Yeah. Mostly. Well, I'd say it's probably, you're right. It's actually a combination of both because deal people now want to know where the money's coming from and whether it would be of interest.
Sure.
And what, and so it's a lot of powwow sessions more than, anything else. And it's a collaboration and that's really what it is. It's trying to sort of, but, renewable energy has been something that we've been interested in. We actually, we have a sustainability department here. So it started there that sort of led to maybe renewables. Obviously renewables is a hot button today. And, we've seen some interesting opportunities, wind farm. We have this property, this biofeed deal we're refining down in Mississippi. And I think it's just a natural, expansion of this firm's, you know,
impact and
entrepreneurial spirit to try new things. And we got comfortable with it enough where we're offering like a debt position on it because we're thinking about risk.
Yeah.
So again, that's like an example where we're willing to sort of insulate the investor to the extent that we can on some basis, as opposed to, you know, saying, come on in and putting all the capital at risk. So that's something that we're working on now. But I see that continuing. I see that business continuing. I see new things. I could see data or IT-related things sort of popping up. I mean, I think the my favorite thing about sort of, like on any given day, I can work on anything. Yeah. And I think, I mean, maybe because I'm senior and because, but I like to think that like there's that sort of energy here where you can, you see an opportunity, start vetting it. You know, I always tell my team, they have an idea, sell it to me. Like, sell it to me. And that's usually like a start point on like, does it have some basic metrics that like you might want to explore? But it's a process. So,
Last little topic, who along the way, you've rattled off quite a few people and obviously Francis and Robert, but who else along the way has served a significant impact for you just in your career or maybe in real estate as a whole? Like who were a mentor to, like who were the guys that really, or gals that helped you the most, do you think?
That's an interesting question. So, you know, Bob and Francis obviously have been great mentors. I've learned a lot. I've also learned from them what not to do in certain instances and mistakes that they've made. And I've tried to apply it in my own life and thinking. And that, I mean, in like the most respectful of ways, meaning like I love that there is that entrepreneurial spirit because it leads you down all these different paths. But I also look at things like how I'm leading my team and where I've sort of learned those things. It's hard to identify it as a particular person. I mean, there's things I've drawn from my brother, my sister, I have a very close family, where I try and apply my life lessons into what I do every day. I've been doing that more and more lately. You know, I send my team stuff over the weekend about wellness, like health wellness stuff.
Cool.
You know, you see this guy here. So I have a little bit of a spiritual sense to it. And it's like, mostly I find that, ambition, leadership, inspiration, like it comes in different sources. So like I've pulled different, things. I mean, one of the great things about technology today is you can sort of pull it from a lot of people. And so in past years, although I was trained a certain way, you know, one of the problems by being trained a certain way is that your brain becomes focused on doing that routine. And I heard this from Tony Robbins recently, not to sound like a cliche, but you know, sometimes like having the same job for a long time, it can be good, but it can be bad too, in the sense that like, you know, you process your normal routine and you think along those lines and your brain gets, and then stepping out of your comfort zone becomes that much more challenging. So, you know, I have now of the opinion, and this is something I just, in the last few years, as I've sort of grown and we've, my team has expanded and we've had success, start thinking about stepping out of my zone a little bit. And so that's led to a whole bunch of things where I have a lot of mentors, but they're not necessarily in the real estate business. And, you know, a lot of what I do is relationship building. you know, I advise a lot of college kids and people looking to get their career started. I get asked a lot what people should do. I had someone recently was asking me, you know, getting into the business school, one of the competitive business schools. And they said, well, what would be your next major? Now, this is just me speaking.
Right. You know, that's okay. Like,
I was like, well, psychology, you know, because in my, like what I find I spend most of my time doing is dealing with people and understanding like certain things. And like, mm-hmm. there's an element to that. So my mentors are widespread, but I, you know, I try and just learn each day. So I take a little bit from people and I try and learn from when I do something wrong. You know, I look at it a little bit differently about mentor, protege, whatever. But there's times when my team will bring me something and I encourage them to speak up. And I don't want to be like headstrong about being right or wrong. Sort of like, okay, let's all reflect and like, let's try and get to the best place. So I've learned those mechanisms. A lot of it's been just through my network of friends and family. Yeah. To be honest with you, that have just come across my life in different ways.
Fascinating.
And, you know, I try and apply that to a lot. And I get a lot of people who tell me, like, you know, you're now becoming one of my mentors because you're thinking out of the box and you're, you know, and but yet I substantially have the background. So it's, I always find that if you can be substantive, like, you know, when you're raising money, which is sort of, I'm not selling it. Just being me, I'm bringing my experience to the table and I'm trying to expand.
Mm-hmm.
So those things, I would say are most important to me, my growth.
I love it. I think that's a great place to wrap, so to speak. Quinn PR team did an amazing job setting this up. So
yeah,
big
they're
thanks,
great. Yeah,
big
thank
thanks
you.
To them.
Thank you very much for that.
Carly,
it was great
did
to have
a great
you
job.
In.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah.
David, thanks
yeah,
for coming
pleasure.
On the show.
This
thanks
was
for
great.
Doing this.